So Andrea does not need much of an introduction for most of us here. Dragonheart Ryushin Andrea Thatch will tell us today about Zen life, enlightened life, the teaching of Sochun Mel Weitzman. So like I said before, many of us will remember Andrea, who practiced with the Red Cedar Zen community in Bellingham from 2015 to 2019. And then she left us and went back to Berkeley. Her practice began much sooner than that. She started practicing in 1994. And she was ordained in 2005 and received Dharma transmission from her teacher, Sochun Mel Weitzman. So thank you very much for coming and giving a talk. We thank you.
Before I thank you all, I guess we do the opening chant. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. So good morning, everyone. It's so wonderful to see familiar faces. Talis, with your hair shorter than I think I've ever seen it, and some new faces as well. It's terrific to be here, and it can't help but evoke the feeling of the Red Cedar Zendo, where so many of you practiced for so many years and felt like a special home for a while. So I'm delighted to be here for Zen Alive. And when Chris told me that the topic for the year was going to be enlightenment, I thought about that. And I also, that invite came around the same time that my teacher, my transmitting and ordaining teacher, was dying of cancer. And I don't know how many of you are aware of who Sochun Mel Weitzman was, but I wanted to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about his teachings on enlightenment. And I'll start by saying that when that idea came to my mind, I asked some of the other senior students, long-term practitioners at Berkeley Zen Center, like, do you know any talks that Mel gave on enlightenment, or what do you think he would say about it? And almost to a person, they said, oh, he never talked about that. But actually, when I did some searches and looked through some of the old lectures, I think just about everything he talked about was enlightenment. So we're gonna open that up a little bit. Sochun Weitzman was 91 when he died. He was the transmitting teacher for 30 different teachers. One of the early ones was Noman's teacher, Norman Fisher, who many of you have studied with. So his thumbprints are well over the Shunryu Suzuki lineage in this country. I had the great honor to take care of him for the last months of his death, and that really informed some of my thinking about what I wanted to say today. He was, in a very quiet way, very well known. As I said, he had many transmitted students. He also was one of the people who was involved with starting the Soto Zen Buddhist Association in America. He was foundational in developing bridges between Japan and America as we were establishing our own lineage and our American way here. He was one of the founding members of the American Zen Teachers Association that brought together Rinzai and Soto teachers. So he had stature among his peers, although I don't think he was particularly well known. The truth is he was also abbot at San Francisco Zen Center. And while the almost 35 years that he was abbot at Berkeley Zen Center. And of all the people, of all the disciples of Suzuki Roshi, of which there were many, he felt to be the one who most understood and embodied Suzuki Roshi's teaching. Suzuki Roshi being the person who brought Zen to America in the current forms that we're all used to. They're the forms that were transmitted through San Francisco Zen Center onto Norman, onto Noman, and to you. Mel didn't really stand out. He wasn't very flashy, and he didn't make much of a splash in the Zen world larger than the than Berkeley and the wider Bay Area. I wanted to say a little bit about his history to you to give you a sense of him, giving you a sense of how he lived his life and who he was as a person, to help you understand what he would say and why people didn't think he talked about enlightenment so much. Mel came to Zen a little bit later. He was in his late 30s. He had been, among other things, a cab driver and a boat painter. Grew up in a poor Depression household. He was born in 29. And he didn't go to college. He just went right out into the world. He seemed like kind of an unlikely plain fella. When I think about it, there are lots of stories of Mel as a cab driver in San Francisco, kind of making his fare, getting to the place where the person had arrived, and sitting in the car and talking with them for some time. Already, even at that point before he came to Zen, he was interested in people, interested in what made them up, and there for them. So he seemed, in fact, in San Francisco Zen circles, he seemed rather like the dumb guy of all the people who were around Suzuki Roshi. He was the one who wasn't so scholarly, didn't seem to relate to the sutras that well, didn't really stand out. The truth is, he had an interesting background. He studied painting with Clifford Still. If any of you know abstraction, someone's raising their hand. If you ever, anyone knows about abstract expressionism in post-World War II, Clifford Still was one of the founders of that. And Mel was actually a very accomplished painter. His career was beginning to take off before he fell into Zen. Like many of us, there was something that he recognized that was missing, that he was open for at a time when something was happening in San Francisco and something that was happening in the art community who was around. There's an early story of him going to sit his first sesshin. Some of the kind of beat people and poets and the crowd that he was around had found this little Japanese man in Japantown and were going to sit zazen with him, kind of a novelty. It was interesting. It was kind of felt like it was alive. And he went to sit his first sesshin, and it was really hard. You could relate to that. It was really hard. His knees hurt, his ankles hurt, and he was incredibly restless. And I don't know if it was on that one day or it was a multi-day, and at one point he just got up and he left it during a period of Kinhin. He was out of there. And he went out and walked down to the Embarcadero in San Francisco and walked around and walked around, and he came back. he realized that there was nothing else that he wanted to do. There was nothing else that called his life or was important to him besides sitting Zen. And so that was really the beginning. He had found himself. He had an immediate affinity with Suzuki Roshi. He felt something about his style. It was very intuitive. Suzuki Roshi also didn't seem like he was, in a way, very bright or very showy. His early lectures, I understand the first several years of his lectures, not just because he didn't speak English well and there was no one who could translate fluently for him, weren't really all that terrific. But there was something about being around him that Mel understood. He understood intuitively what Suzuki Roshi was transmitting, what Zen was. And that's what I'm getting to here in talking about his enlightenment. All those years, Mel was a lay practitioner. He used to go and sit Zazen in San Francisco in the early morning hours. He'd always wear the same sweater with holes in it. You can imagine the starving artist. And he had patches everywhere. And one morning, Suzuki Roshi took it and touched and said, "That's your robe. That's your robe." And maybe a few years later, he and Mel were practicing together, doing something, and Suzuki Roshi said to him, "I'd like you to join our order." And what he was saying is, "I'd like you to ordain as a priest." Mel was one of the first five. And he sent him off to Berkeley. Eventually, he said, I'd like you to find a place in Berkeley and make a place where people can sit, be the caretaker." Mel said, "I always felt like I was the caretaker there." And Suzuki Roshi would come on Monday mornings to the attic of this old Victorian house where you had to duck to get in there to be able to go in and sit Zazen. Slowly over time, he had been ordained. He finally received Dharma transmission after Suzuki Roshi died and wasn't installed as abbot until 21 years after the doors of Berkeley Zen Center first opened. He wasn't pushing. He wasn't trying to make anything happen. He wasn't looking for anything. Very organic. In fact, the first years that after BZC had moved to its current site, about a mile away, there was a little garden next door, and he was always gardening. And he felt like cultivating a Zen community was rather like cultivating a garden. And in it was a one-room schoolhouse, which was the Zendo. And his idea of the one-room schoolhouse is that everyone would practice together and everyone would support everyone else, no matter what their experience or training was. Everyone was teaching everyone, both equally and based on their experience. So that's how Berkeley Zen Center came to be, and something of Mel's background. So I want to talk about Mel's enlightenment, if you will, or his teaching of his enlightenment as part of everyday life. You already get a little flavor of that, don't you? It wasn't about rituals and bells and whistles and fancy lectures, although he was an excellent lecturer, but it was really about a kind of cultivation and awareness. We usually think of enlightenment as something that is really exalted, where we transcend our usual ways of being. And maybe once you've had it, you can't really go back to the way it was before. I don't think Mel really thought that way, or at least that was not at all his emphasis, which is why folks would say he didn't really talk about it. So I'd say yes and no. I think Mel would say rather like Buddha nature, It's not that you have it or you don't have it, but rather you be it or you exhibit it. We all are to our Soto Zen school of thinking. We all are completely Buddha nature. Sometimes we're not as in touch with that in ourselves, and usually that's the clouding of our own mind. Likewise, our expression of that, which is enlightened activity, is always there and always available. That's really the key to Sojin, and I think Suzuki Roshi's understanding. The more I've, you know, in the event of Sojin's death, we've all been revisiting his life and his teachings. We've all been rereading what he's written. And the more and more I do it, the closer I see he is to Suzuki Roshi in his manifestations. A lot of the words and phrases he used are exactly the same. So there's a delusion within enlightenment and enlightenment within delusion, which really means your everyday life has absolutely everything that it needs in order to manifest enlightenment. It's not some state over there or that you get to after 10 or 30 or 50 years of practice. That's what he would say. Suzuki Roshi said, the ordinary way practiced thoroughly is enlightenment. Talk a little bit about that, what that means to practice thoroughly, to leave nothing out, to include everything, including those things either within yourself, or in your mind, in my mind, or out there that we think are like, I've got to get rid of that. Got to wash that clean. Oh, no, not that can't be so. How practice thoroughly, meaning to digest it thoroughly, to not be pulled around by it, to accept it as part of the warts on your nose that you're born with, the form that you take, your height, your personality, your familial upbringing, all of that is part of your enlightenment, even if sums of it are an obstacle to you, or it seems like they're an obstacle for you. It's common in our circles, Zen circles. It was really common in San Francisco Zen Center in the years that I practiced there, that we'd say we raise the thought of enlightenment. You know, that's the thought of bodhicitta, right? That's that first coming to practice and going, wow, yeah, that's it. That's how I want to live. That's what really matters to me, that raising the thought of your enlightenment, which seems kind of exalted and fancy. I think of it a little bit of the kind of atmosphere that I can imagine revolving around San Francisco Zen Center after Dick Baker died. I mean, after Suzuki Roshi died and Dick Baker, who was entrepreneurial, really big, bright mind, big vision about what was going to happen. There was Tassajara that was being developed. He was the brains behind Green Gulch. There was a bakery in San Francisco. All of this bigness, that's kind of raising the thought of enlightenment, something big and grand. And Sojin just enjoyed the practice. He didn't try to raise the thought of enlightenment. The atmosphere of practice itself was just very compelling, and the most vital part of practice was to be able to deal with difficulty. Sojin just enjoyed the practice. He didn't try to make anything. He met it where it was. And that's another quality of his expression of practice that I think we all, those of us who were able to practice with him, really valued. Whatever was happening right in front of you was the show. It was the whole big deal, even though no one was making a big deal of it. That's where the energy, that's where the life was. It wasn't supposed to look a particular way. Whatever was there was it. He said, our Zazen is our everyday life. So everyday life is in Zazen, everything shows up. All the workings of our minds, our stories, our ideas, our feelings, everything is there. Our past, our present, our ideas of the future, it's all right there in our everyday life. Everything is there. Zazen, we develop this stability to transcend our ideas about it. He said, don't stick to Zazen. If after Sesshin you feel happy, go home to your life, then you've really sat Zazen. If you feel hesitant to leave, then you're stuck to Zazen. When you practice moment after moment, then you just accept whatever is, and you don't have any complaints. You won't have any complaints. When you enjoy the practice, you don't have to stick to it. You have a taste for it all the time. So it doesn't have to be in the monastery. It doesn't have to be on the cushion. We have to practice those ways. Another one of Sojin's phrases that stands out to me is, enlightenment is an accident, but by sitting Zazen and practicing, you become accident prone. By being sitting Zazen, by being willing to drop everything and be present to the moment. We'll talk a little bit about this next. Everything manifests itself. You don't have to try and make it happen. Sitting Zazen makes you prone to having your small mind take its proper place and your big mind manifest. So in preparing for this, I went over a series of Mel's talks that were given at Chapel Hill Zen Center at Pat Phelan's place. Pat was one of his early deshi, Dharma heirs, and for many years Mel would go and travel there to give a series of lectures and a kind of teaching sesshin. So there are lectures on the Heart Sutra there are lectures on the Genjo Koan that are there, among other things that you'll find that he's spoken about. When I think about enlightenment, everyday enlightenment, it really is Genjo Koan. For those of you who know Genjo Koan, it's one of Dogen Zenji, the founder of the Soto Zen School's foundational teachings. And it's really about manifesting enlightenment in our everyday life. So I wanted to talk, I took a portion of one of Mel's talks and I kind of extrapolated and added a few of my own comments, but I wanted to give you some of his words too, so that you could hear his voice and the way that he speaks about his understanding of coming to terms with his own difficulties and finding his way to a kind of freedom. He wouldn't use that word, but he would like that word. So Genjo Koan, that's kind of pivotal, pithy. I'm watching the time. Chris or Desiree is the Tenkan. Give me a hand if I'm talking too long, so we can open it up, but I'll get going on this section of my talk. So Genjo Koan is probably all of the Shobo Genzo revolves around Genjo Koan. The rest of the Shobo Genzo is a commentary, if you will, on the enlightenment or the manifestation of our everyday life in practice. And one of the pithy paragraphs in it, which many of us who've been around Zen for any time have as echoes within ourselves, is the paragraph, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas. To be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free one's body and mind and those of others. No trace of enlightenment remains, and the traceless element is continued forever. So those encouraging words for Sojin had echoes in Tozen's five ranks. Tozen's five ranks are some idea about spiritual development that Tozen developed. Mel didn't like the idea of a certain path, a prescriptive way in practice, but you might say it's rather like reading anything or looking at a map. It helps orient. It helps orient you to some aspect of your experience as a practitioner. So to lightly make a reference to that, but to talk about each line by line with Mel's comments. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self. Might be likened to aspiration, that rousing the thought of enlightenment, or that feeling like I have nothing else to do. I'm walking here in the Embarcadero, which has all the goodies in the world and all the sense delights and everything else, but there's really nothing here for me. That recognition that there's something else that's missing or something else that's outside of me that's important might be called the shift to move from living by karma to living by vow, to orient to practice, where everything starts to be about practice. Do you remember, those of you who are here, I don't know all of you, but I think many of us have the experience of when we first come to practice, recognizing, wow, this is, you know, this really fills a need. This really addresses something within me that I couldn't have articulated, or maybe I hadn't found before. It's kind of like that. So practice becomes the compass by which you orient. He manifested that as a teacher, I would say also, by not having personal aspirations. He said, a good teacher doesn't want anything for himself. And a Zen person doesn't want anything for herself. Meaning it's the beginning of orienting towards a less selfish life. To recognize that your life is part of something bigger. He was a pretty important person. He, you know, was abbot at San Francisco Zen Center and Berkeley Zen Center. He helped found these organizations. He was well regarded internationally, but people didn't know who he was. His personal aspiration was to live by what he was called to do and not in search for anything. Something that really underscored that for me is, as he had cancer, and as he began, first as he got older, he went from being in the Zendo twice a day, 5 days a week in our Saturday program, to taking a Thursday off, and then occasionally to missing or sharing his teaching seat, because he used to give all the lectures. We sat 5:40 Zazen in the morning, 5:40 in the afternoon. He was always there. And for 4 days a week and Saturdays, he was always there. For Sashin's 5 a.m., he was always there. As he got older, he wasn't at the Zendo so very much. He called it taking a sabbatical, his cancer sabbatical, to work on his writings. And one day we were taking a walk. Mel had a way of being very personal. It's very, very intimate. And he said, almost in this kind of confessional way, he said, I really enjoy sleeping in. You know, he's 90. I really enjoy sleeping in. And I went, oh? And he said, yeah, I'm really a night owl. I have a hard time getting in bed before midnight or one. And I just had this, like, my head split open. You mean for 50 years, you've been getting up at 4:30 in the morning or four, he rode his bike from his house to the Zendo. So you mean you're getting up at 4:15 every morning for all those years, not complaining? You never knew that the guy didn't want to be up and be there. You never knew what a struggle it was for him to give up his late night hours and his usual biological clock. He just did it because that was just the practice. You know, I see echoes of the early echoes of his teacher's teaching. There's a famous story of this is at San Francisco Zen Center, which is an old it's an old dorm for nuns. You know, three flights of stairs up and down. The Tenkan gets up to ring the bell to let people know to get up in the early morning hours, and that usually goes off, I think, at, let's say, 4 a.m. It gets up really early. So the bell goes up and people start to get up and go down, and Suzuki Roshi gets dressed and goes down. And some people start to realize that the Tenkan was an hour early. And they say, oh, we're an hour early. We'll go back to bed now. And so they went back to bed. It was actually Mel who had rung the bell. He had made the mistake, so he was correcting the mistake. Suzuki Roshi went down there and sat because the bell had gone off. So when everyone came up an hour later, he got up off his seat after they were settled and took the kaisaku, the wake-up stick, and he got every single one of them. It's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? The bell went off. Come and sit zazen. Keep the schedule. And this teacher really took that, you know, Mel really took that to heart. All those years, it lasted him all those years of getting up at 4 a.m. Maybe that's enough on that. There's so many stories to tell you, so many encouragements to give you. The second line of Genjo Koan is to study the self is to forget the self. He calls that willing submission. So there's aspiration and willing submission. Willing submission means don't be self-centered. Let go of your resistances. Let go of your self-centeredness. Be Buddha-centric instead of self-centric and putting oneself into the surface of the Buddha Dharma. Let me say that again. Those are his words. Let go of resistances. Let go of self-centeredness. Be Buddha-centric instead of self-centric, or putting oneself in the service of the Buddha Dharma. Living by vow instead of by karma. That's a little bit more than that. You know, I think living by vow instead of by karma is a great aspiration. It's what I hold in my heart with practice. May I do this. And then willing submission is you really have to do this. You really have to commit to it. You really have to try hard to do this. There was a time, like for many of us, that I think Mel got a little discouraged in practice. Nothing seemed to be happening particularly. And he went to Suzuki Roshi and he said, do you think I can do this? And Suzuki Roshi said to him, do you think I should stop practicing? And Suzuki Roshi said, don't you think that this is difficult enough for you? If you can find something more difficult, you should do that. In other words, I think the key to living freely is to be willing to do what's the hardest for you. And I don't mean like carrying 100 pounds up a side of a mountain, but I mean letting go of self-centeredness is darn difficult, really darn difficult. And zazen is one way of getting to see who we are in the midst of this. Another dimension of this is to not create an opposition, which I think is the kind of a prelude to the next part of Genjo Koan. He says, not, I think this is a key element of entering into the non-dual, that is, not setting up something outside of yourself. To let go of one's self-centered ideas means to be open to other things, means to be open to other perspectives, other ideas, other that the world doesn't look, it doesn't revolve around me and my ideas of what it is or what it should be. That it's unknowable because it's made of so many different perspectives. Don't set up something outside of yourself or kind of the training wheels for that. He said, specifically thinking about being in pain when you sit in Zazen, that those really early experiences that we have when we sit, that most people experience when they sit, that it's just physically really difficult. If you set up an opposition, there's me wanting my comfort and there's the pain that I wish would go away. The experience of that usually is pretty painful. It doesn't go away in that paradigm. But if you're willing to open to it, kind of to accept that that's the somatic experience in the moment, something else is possible. But when there's just a duality between the two of them, just a tension, just a me versus you, then your tormentor doesn't go away. It just becomes bigger, bigger. Mel says of that time, none of us could sit very well. It was hard on our ankle bones. At that time, there were very few people who could sit well. So we all had a very difficult time sitting, and that was very much the feeling. It was really hard to do Zazen because we didn't have the experience. You know, I think nowadays we have the good fortune of, you have people who've been sitting at Red Cedar for 30 years, and they're pretty comfortable with their Zazen. So they're an encouragement for people who haven't been sitting as long. So you kind of see, well, maybe it is possible to do this. At least it could be encouraging. But he says, it was really hard to do Zazen. We didn't have the experience. Suzuki Roshi used to urge me on, don't move. Sometimes we'd be sitting, and after about 40 minutes, just before it was time for the bell to ring, he would say, we will sit 10 minutes longer. And so it was a wonderful surprise. Yeah, a wonderful surprise. You can tell he understood on some level. The wonderful surprise that, oh, I have to figure my way out of this because I'm not going to get up and leave. How am I going to do this now? That's the willing submission. How am I going to do this now? The next part of Genjo Koan is to forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. In my mind, this is what I usually think about as an enlightenment. Like, I drop enough of my way of seeing things to have some experience of what we call emptiness. Some experience that there's something there's something else out there that's functioning and I'm functioning in the midst of it. When we stop chasing after things and grasping after them with our ideas of wanting something from them, we see them reveal themselves. And that's how we set them free, and we are set free. His actual teaching of this was very good in words, but I think the way he showed us was the way in which he handled things. So the way in which, instead of moving the zabuton, the big black cushion on the floor with his foot, he would pick it up and shift it. You don't treat things like objects. The way when you would hand him his teacup, if you were his jisha, he would take it in both hands and you would feel the weight of his hands on the cup at the same time your hands were on the cup. So there is a real connection between the two of you. And where at the altar, before he would do service, he was always rearranging things. We used to joke about that, oh, Mel is nesting, or Mel just has to have it be just so. But actually, he was feeling the harmony of the objects on the altar and harmonizing with them. He was bringing them all into harmony at the altar. That was so much about his teaching. can't say how incredible, how astute he was working with his students. He observed each of us. He had a pretty clear idea of what was going on. And he was ready with a turning word or often with an action, which again, I think is an echo of how he apprenticed with his teacher. I remember when I came back from Tassajara 20 years ago, all full of light and enthusiasm. And I was going around the Zendo after a Saturday program, and I was fluffing all the cushions, you know, the way you're supposed to fluff the kapok on the zabuton and make it look nice. And I was doing that to each of them. And Mel circled back around when he was done bowing everyone out. So when people walked out of the Zendo door, he would wait and bow to everyone. He was done. He circled back around and noticed my energy doing that. And he got down on his knees next to me. And he took the zabuton and he positioned it for me. He showed me. It was a body-to-body kind of transmission of not treating things like objects, allowing myself to interact with it. I could give you many more examples of that. That's one. He says, the humility is to know who you are. To know who you are. That means neither too big nor too small. You know your proper place, your proper functioning with things. So when you know your proper functioning, you don't have to elevate yourself. You don't put yourself down falsely. You just fit in. You just harmonize with those things. This is one of my favorite lines in the Genjo Koan, to find your place right where you are. Actualizes the fundamental point. That's what actualizes enlightenment, if you will. Fish swim the water, never reach the end of the water. You're always in your right place. If you're being a fish, you're always in your right place in the water, no matter where in the water you are. There are two more lines to Genjo Koan, then I think I'll bypass the rest of what I was going to say so we can talk a little bit. So to be enlightened, line 4, he calls combined virtue or collective achievement. The fourth sentence of Dogen is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free one's body and mind and those of others. So our work is actually to benefit not only ourselves, but others as well. This is what Tozen calls combined virtue or collective achievement. It's characterized by the samadhi of receiving and the samadhi of giving. Samadhi, open, deep, receptive presence without an abiding self. Jijiyu samai is self-joyous or self-fulfilling samadhi. Taiji Juyu Samadhi is others' fulfillment. Jijiyu means that you receive and enjoy the light of your own true nature, your essence of mind. Essence of mind was a favorite reference of Sojin's. It's from the Platform Sutra in Wei Nan. It might be thought of the bright clarity of light, the bright light of clarity before conceptualization is how I think about it. Taijiyu means that you use what you receive to help bring others into realization. If we don't use our realization to help bring forth the light in others, it will not sustain itself. So one is turning the light inward to receive and turning to illuminate in others. We're strobe lights shining in all different directions around and around. The absolute, everything as it is, and the relative world of duality, the rules, don't harm things. The third side is to go beyond both sides, to see one within the other, as if they're the same, neither is separate. The oneness of duality and the duality of oneness was Dogen and Sojin's great teaching. So one more section. Dogen's fifth sentence is no trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment is continued forever. That's the final rank of Tozan. It's called unity attained. This is where one is no longer concerned about enlightenment or delusion. It is when one embodies enlightenment and realization totally without the need to do anything special, but is ceaselessly working for the benefit of all beings without any special effort or even self-consciousness. There is no clinging to enlightenment or delusion. One has perfect freedom in all aspects of life. It is the culmination of mind and body dropping. Gosh, I could say so many things here, but what just comes to my mind as I'm writing, as I'm telling you this is, when it was really clear when Mel's cancer had progressed, he had lived with it for almost a year, a very serious form of cancer. So everyone was surprised, but when it was clear it was progressing, he began having Thursday evening public dokusans, and so a few of you were there. He would open up the zendo, and as many as 40 or so people would show up, and anyone who wanted to could ask him a question. There were these very intimate exchanges. And his lectures focused around teachings on birth and death. And he was totally giving himself up to us. He was continuing to teach. He was offering his experience to us. He was empathizing with our experience in his passing. He was burning himself up and leaving nothing behind. The last lucid day, some of us had the opportunity to visit him fairly frequently once he was bedbound and on hospice. And the last lucid day that he had, the few of us who got to see him that day, to a person, he asked us how we were, or said, "This has to be really hard for you." I felt like, you know, that's a kind statement. But I had the feeling that he was offering so much more of himself in the process. He was okay with it, but this has to be really hard for you. So I've prepared too much, and maybe I'll stop right there so we have a little bit of time for conversation. I really appreciate being able to share something of his life with you, since he never made it to Bellingham or to the Pacific Northwest to teach. And so thank you very much for your attention and for listening. I'll add just two words. There's going to be a book of his lectures and his life story that many of us have been working on preparing, that should be available through Counterpoint Press maybe sometime next year if we're lucky, called The Grindstone. Okay, thank you all very much. And shall we have any comments or experiences or reactions before we do the closing chant? And I don't know.